Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, June 29th, 2018. After a week of darkness and moments of despair, I have a little good news for you. The Democratic National Committee has restored democracy to the Democratic Party's presidential primary process. Hallelujah! And a quick programming note, there's a long holiday next week with July 4th falling in the middle of the week, and your humble host has plans to be here on Monday and then take the rest of the week off. And I'm not traveling, so if Trump explodes or he blows something up, I will be prepared to break my silence and bring you a podcast. But that is my plan as of this moment. So I want to give credit to Norman Solomon and to a number of other activists in the Democratic Party, like Karen Bernal, a delegate from here in California, who joined Solomon in writing the autopsy of the 2016 Democratic Party election primary process. And as I dive into this, I think I should remind you that I am not a member of the Democratic Party. I checked out a long time ago. The last time I registered Democrat, it was to be able to vote for Norman Solomon as a Bernie Sanders delegate to the 2016 convention. And a couple of days after I registered as a Democrat, I re-registered as what we call in California NPP, no party preference. But as an observer of American politics and a longtime critic of the slide into corporatism and irrelevance by the Democratic National Committee, I am thrilled to report to you that yesterday, in a 27-1 vote of the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee, they adopted a new rule that prevents superdelegates from casting decisive votes on the first ballot of presidential nominating conventions. Now, the superdelegates were brought in as a fix to prevent a Jesse Jackson from grabbing the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. It goes all the way back to 1984. And by empowering party leaders and hacks and lobbyists and other people as superdelegates, it really suppressed the direct democracy of the primary process. We know that most of the superdelegates were already committed to Hillary Clinton before a single primary vote or caucus occurred. And in a commentary posted at Consortium News today, Norman Solomon talks about how this goes back to 1984 and that in some ways this was fueled by the upset victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over the party boss Joe Crowley in the New York boroughs. So this is a tremendous step forward, and I did not expect it. Tom Perez is now the chair of the DNC. He was recruited by Obama to prevent Keith Ellison, a true progressive, from rising to chair the DNC. And, of course, the party, the DNC, has imposed the Bernie ban, saying that you cannot get the nomination unless you're a card-carrying Democrat. Now, Bernie may address that. He may join the Democratic Party before the 2020 primary process. But it is a poke in the eye to the grassroots, the activists of the Democratic Party. And it does appear that Crowley's defeat did play a role. It didn't stop good old Donna Brazile, a former DNC chair who was discredited, as she was essentially cuckolded. I know that's a right-wing favorite word these days. But she was just a figurehead after she replaced Debbie Wasserman Schultz as chair of the DNC during the final months of the 2016 campaign. And she was out of the loop on many things that the Clinton campaign was doing as they essentially took over complete control of the DNC. Now, the party's got a long way to go to address its problems. I still consider it a failed brand. I am not optimistic that the Democrats will regain control of the House this fall, and regaining control of the Senate is dicey. And it's made worse by the opening on the Supreme Court, which will, in their minds, force some of the conservadems that I've been talking about the last couple of days, led by Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Bill Nelson of Florida. They're going to feel a lot of pressure to vote for Trump's Supreme Court nominee. And that is part of the lack of courage and principle that undermines the prospects of the Democratic Party today. Here's a patronizing piece in today's Washington Post under the byline of Amber Phillips. And she criticizes Democrats who are advocating for abolishing ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement arm. And it's interesting because I have cautioned that some of the most activist members of the Democratic Party might do some damage with this approach. Now, I certainly am not opposed to abolishing ICE, but I'm a realist, and we will have some sort of a goon squad to patrol the border and pick up people for deportation, whether it's an Obama in the White House or a Trump or anyone else. And so I do take some note that you can't just go blasting, we've got to abolish ICE and then force politicians to adopt that position. But what's interesting is with the advocacy for abolishing ICE from Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, her senior senator from the state of New York, let me correct that, Kirsten Gillibrand is the junior senator, Schumer is the senior. But Gillibrand, who had supported Joe Crowley because they're old political partners, she came around and I heard the quote on CNN last night. She was asked about abolishing ICE, and she said, well, I agree with it. I don't think ICE today is working as intended. I believe that it has become a deportation force, and I think you should separate the criminal justice from the immigration issues, and I think you should reimagine ICE under a new agency with a very different mission and take those two missions out. Now, the fear is, and Amber Phillips has a point, that Trump won't pay attention to the final qualifying lines that Gillibrand gave in her answer. Trump will only hear, I agree with it, I don't think ICE is working as intended, and he'll go into his spiel that all the Democrats want open borders and criminals to pour over them. Yesterday I mentioned the letter from 19 top ICE agents across the country. These are the investigator guys, not the bustin' immigrant guys. And they claim that they want to split up ICE and have a new name for the people who do the investigations. So there's a lot of movement on this issue, and Democrats shouldn't shy away from it. But in the age of Trump, we do have to fear that just like Hillary's comment about the deplorables, which has been taken out of context and used as a powerful weapon against her, when you listen to the full quote of what she said, she had empathy for the people she called deplorable. And that, of course, never surfaces, as the soundbite lives on and the context does not. Yesterday, as many as 600 people were arrested in the Hart Senate office building, where they took over a lobby and did a sit-in, protesting the zero-tolerance policy toward immigrants and separation of families at the border. The best-known arrestee was Susan Sarandon, but also House Member Pramila Jayapal, Democrat from Seattle, was among those arrested. There's a picture here of Senator Elizabeth Warren on a balcony above the protests, cheering them on. Jeff Merkley was among those senators who addressed the crowd there. And I applaud this kind of activism. We need more of it. And I hope to see more in the coming months. And I hope people will not get sidetracked by this call for civility, which we'll address here in a moment. Now today, the three African-American members of the United States Senate, Democrats Kamala Harris of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey, and Republican Tim Scott of North Carolina are introducing a bill that will, for the first time, have federal criminal penalties for lynching. Senator Harris said lynching is a dark, despicable part of our history. We must acknowledge that, lest we repeat it. She said from 1882 to 1986, there have been 200 attempts that have failed to get Congress to pass federal anti-lynching legislation. And she said it's time for that to change. Mitch McConnell was quizzed on this, and he said, I thought LBJ signed a bill like that. But he did say, if that's not the case, that he would support it. Now, I think this is interesting, because let's point out the politics here. I certainly support the spirit of this legislation, and there are many Democrats who have already signed on as co-sponsors. But this is a substitute for reparations for slavery. This is being used as a device to connect with African American voters. And both Booker and Harris are frequently mentioned, and they don't deny their interest in running for president as soon as 2020. So we cannot dismiss the politics of what is, I think, a well-intentioned bill. Maxine Waters, the fiery African American congresswoman from Los Angeles, who has been in Trump's Twitter crosshairs this week for advocating that Democrats do stand up, that Democrats do call out Trump's toadies. Well, she had to cancel a couple of events, one in Texas, one in Alabama, over the next few days because of what's described as a very serious death threat made on her on Monday from an individual in Texas. And with the mass shooting, five people killed at the offices of the Annapolis Capital Gazette that happened yesterday, I want to be clear that I'm not directly blaming Trump for this. But he issued such a weak and insincere statement today. He said, this attack shocked the conscience of our nation and filled our hearts with grief. Journalists, like all Americans, should be free from the fear of being violently attacked while doing their job. Now, this is the guy who at his rallies cages the reporters and then eggs on his mobs in hateful commentary. So it's okay for Trump to bully and threaten reporters from a podium. And then he can, experience crocodile tears and issue a statement like that. I call bullshit. Good commentary that I've linked to came out of today's New York Times, written by NYU history professor Thomas Sugrue. And he notes that people like David Gergen on CNN, David Axelrod, and Senate leader Chuck Schumer, they're all telling Democrats to be civil. But Sugrue points out that the American Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King knew that they could not really produce change without at times being uncivil. And if you consider the letter that King wrote from the jail in Birmingham, he aimed some of his harshest words toward advocates of civility. Quote, I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action. And so, to be clear, I never counsel violence. I don't support personal attacks. I don't support slapping people, smacking them, punching them in the nose. Even the most deplorable among us. But I do support standing strong, speaking up, countering the lies, the spin, the demagoguery that is coming from the other side. We cannot submit. We cannot capitulate. Here's a really ugly piece of legislation coming out of the do-nothing Congress. You know, they left for the July 4th break without passing an immigration bill, which they earnestly said they were going to do, and that is their goal. at least the Republicans, they don't want to see any immigration legislation this year because the open wound and the way Trump has brutally collected hostages from dreamers to toddlers to those seeking asylum legally at our borders. Well, those divisions have been sown, and not by the Russians, and they will continue. But yesterday, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs unanimously passed a measure that would give the Trump administration power to decide how to punish U.S. companies that engage in or promote boycotts of Israel. Now, this is the follow-on to the ugly legislation that was offered by Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat from Maryland. And this new piece comes from Ed Royce, a Republican Congress member from California. And he wants to empower the White House to set the rules and then enforce them in this unconstitutional effort, an unprecedented effort, to single out a certain type of speech and prohibit it. We are not permitted to boycott, call for divestment or sanctions on the state of Israel. But we can do it to any other entity in the world, including entities here in the United States. Royce's amendment rewrites the bill to direct the administration to issue regulations that prohibit U.S. companies from involvement with the BDS movement. The bill covers those companies that attempt to comply with, further, or support UN or European Union calls for a boycott of Israel, including merely by furnishing information about them. Now, a man who proudly claims to be the Democratic sponsor of the bill in the House is a man I've known for more than 25 years, Congressman Brad Sherman from Sherman Oaks near Los Angeles. And Brad and I teamed up to lead a repeal of the snack tax here in California. We were successful. It was about 1994. And I have my differences with Brad Sherman, particularly when it comes to his lockstep support for the state of Israel. And so Sherman, in words that I can't believe, says, "Let me make it clear, nothing in this bill says that any domestic organization can't protest Israel or boycott its products or those of any other ally of the United States. It simply says we will not allow American citizens to be pressured into that." Well, Brad, when I have time, I'm going to read the bill. So far, I am not persuaded by your comments. And here's Lois Frankel, Democrat from Florida, who doesn't give a shit about the First Amendment because her priority is protecting Israel. Quote, "The BDS movement encourages economic warfare against Israel, our strongest ally in the Middle East, and demonizing Israel harms the world's only Jewish state. It also creates a roadblock to the path for peace," she falsely states. Now, here comes a heartfelt plea from two people who I would describe as humanists in the state of Israel. This is an op-ed from today's Guardian, signed by Ilana Hammerman, an Israeli writer and translator, and David Harel, vice president of the Israel Academy of Sciences and Humanities. And this is a cry for help. Quote, "The state of Israel is facing a catastrophic situation, which could alarmingly soon lead to extensive bloodshed. It's time for the international community to act decisively. Substantive external pressure, political, economic, and cultural, offers the only chance of emerging from this impossible situation before it's too late." Now, those opening lines would lead you to believe that this is a perfect situation to apply boycott, divestment, and sanctions. But the authors say, not a sweeping BDS-style boycott of the country, but diverse, carefully crafted acts of pressure. I believe BDS fits that description. They continue, "We represent a group of intellectuals and cultural figures central to Israeli society, several of whom are renowned in their fields. We are patriotic Israeli citizens who love our country, contribute tirelessly to Israeli science and culture, but we are horrified by the situation and fear deeply for our lives and those of our offspring and for the lives of the 13 million Jews and Arabs who live here and have no other homeland." They talk about the expansion of West Bank settlements, For years, the international community has been talking about a solution based on separate Israeli and Palestinian states coexisting in peace and security. But current Israeli policy renders that impossible. During the 51 years of military rule on the West Bank, Israel has taken over large quantities of land and has placed around 600,000 Israeli citizens there in hundreds of settlements. In contrast, Israel is squeezing the living space of Palestinian residents who enjoy no civil or political rights. So they get it right. They accurately describe the dire situation, the violation of human rights. And they call for, quoting them again, substantive external pressure, political, economic, and cultural. I spell it with a B, a D, and an S. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Let's see who's on my list today. Abby McMillan, Paul Tomaselli, Faith Peoples, Ethan Knox. I invite you to join them. Maybe you can take a break right now from this podcast. Visit peterbcollins.com. You find the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, land on the sign-up page, and in just a few seconds, you can choose a level of support that works for you. If you take out a new annual subscription for $50 and you give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., I will reward you with John Dist's new rock and roll CD called American University. I also want to mention that my friends Roger and Carol Schuler are hitting the bottom of their bank account again. And if you're able and so inclined, and visit legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, if you could drop a few bucks on them, it'll help them get through another tight spot. Today, I'm releasing to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com a new interview with Yasha Levine. He, of course, is the author of Surveillance Valley. He's been exposing Google and the other tech companies here on this podcast for several years now. And here's an excerpt where Yasha talks about the recent protests by Google employees over a specific contract with the Pentagon. And he notes that, well, they haven't been following what goes on at the Googleplex.
Well, my general comment about this controversy is that it's very ahistorical. It ignores Google's longstanding relationships with the military-industrial complex, and it's more than a decade of contracting with the Pentagon, with the CIA, with intelligence agencies like the NSA. So this is people are hyper focused on this one contract, on this one program to develop AI capability for drone visual recognition systems, but it ignores Google's history of being what you know is in essence a military contractor, a kind of modern Lockheed Martin for the internet age. And you know, this contracting goes back to almost the very beginnings of this company, to the early 2000s. The earliest contract that I could dig up went back to 2003, when Google sold its search technology. So it installed custom-made Google search boxes inside the NSA's data warehouses.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Yasha Levine. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. Well, the New York Times is getting out the worry beads and squeezing them hard. The worry is that Donald Trump will make concessions when he meets with Putin on July 16th in Helsinki. In the past few weeks, fears up the New York Times, Trump has called for Russia to be readmitted to the Group of Seven, suggested it had a legitimate claim to Crimea, and continued to cast doubt about whether Moscow meddled in the 2016 election. Now, these are all tenets, T-E-N-E-T-S, of the New York Times in the current era. And they go on to cite Michael McFaul, who was Obama's ambassador to Moscow and who is a typical promoter of the Russiagate scandal. And he's appalled. And he's worried. Now, I have to say that, like everybody else, I think it's weird that Trump is drawn to autocrats. He wants the approval of Putin and Xi Jinping, and he's cozied up to Kim Jong-un. At the same time, Crimea is over. That is a settled matter. Russia's not giving it up, and we're not getting, you know, going to get it back for Ukraine. And we know that the allegations of Russian meddling in the election have really, in many cases, evaporated to really, really modest and minor claims. We've learned about how they greased the skids to get Anthony Kennedy to resign from the Supreme Court. They plied him with flattery, and one of the key connections that I'm only learning about today is that Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin, spent more than a decade as Trump's banker at Deutsche Bank, rising to become global head of real estate capital markets. He worked closely with Trump. Over $1 billion in loans came from Deutsche Bank to the Trump entities. That's really slimy. Trump went to Wisconsin yesterday to praise Foxconn, the near slave shop operator in China, manufacturer of many electronic devices. They're opening a what they call a $10 billion high-tech campus outside Milwaukee. The wages will be about $25 an hour. The state of Wisconsin is going to have to wait 40 years to recover the inducements that they've given to Foxconn. So there's Trump celebrating this foreign entity which is pretending to build products in the United States. They're not going to reduce their headcount in China, where they enjoy incredible profit margins. They're going to go through the motions of creating and manufacturing here in the United States. And Trump continued to dump on Harley-Davidson, also from Wisconsin, because this week they announced they might do some manufacturing offshore so that they can sell products into the EU without having to pay the tariffs that Trump has brought on. And in the New York Times today, Paul Krugman, the economist and columnist, gets it right. He says Trump's alleged experts in the White House, well, none of them has the slightest idea what he or she is doing. And he says that Trump's view seems to be that since he schmoozed with the company's executive and gave its stockholders a big tax cut, Harley owes him personal fealty and shouldn't respond to the incentives his policies have created. And he also appears to believe that he has the right to deal out personal punishment to companies that displease him. And I think it's important to note that Harley is not a big employer or a, you know, a big factor in the American economy. It's iconic. But his bullying of Harley, I hope, would get him on the shit list of some Hell's Angels. Meanwhile, Mike Pence dragged his knuckles all the way to Guatemala City, where he got together with the president of Guatemala, Salvador, that's El Salvador, and Honduras. And he lectured them. He loves the Bible, so he used a biblical reference. He said that these countries must do more to stop migrants who enter the U.S. illegally. Quote, this exodus must end. And I credit Vice News, which often carries water for the U.S. government and doesn't really like to point out unpleasant history. They're very much in the present in their coverage. But there's a great piece at Vice News today about the history of U.S. involvement in Central and South America. And it serves up evidence for the argument that I've been making here the last few days, that the U.S. is directly responsible for the crisis in Central America that causes people to want to migrate to the United States. Going back to the coup in Guatemala in the 1950s over the United Fruit Company, then in the 70s and the 80s, the war on drugs, Reagan's involvement with the Contras and attempting to control the movements in Central and South America. And then you come to the present day where, of course, Trump repeatedly makes false claims about MS-13, which started in Los Angeles. Anyway, it's a good piece. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. Yesterday, I mentioned that here in California, Governor Brown was preparing to sign a watered-down version of an internet privacy bill that purports to give you and me control over our data. But the tech industries intervened and in order to block a ballot measure that would have been put up to voters in November. The legislature hustled, and this week they rammed through legislation that is weaker than the ballot measure, but appears to meet the minimum standards of the ballot measure's author, Alistair McTaggart. So that's one set of cave-ins to powerful industries here in California. But here's another that's even stinkier. And I referenced it yesterday, and I may have mischaracterized it a little bit. But here's the deal. The soft drink manufacturers were putting their own ballot measure on in November. In order to block future soda taxes, they want to raise the threshold so that local communities can't pass a tax with just a majority. They want a supermajority of two-thirds. So they use that to blackmail the governor and the legislature. And to some extent, that may just be cover for Jerry Brown, because his history shows that he is an apologist for many industries. The frackers, the oil companies, The people who operate the Porter Ranch natural gas facility that had a huge methane leak that lasted for months. Well, the shakedown worked. The tax ban went through the legislature. And the new law says that no local government can raise taxes on sodas for the next 12 years. And finally today, a new report based on research from Oxford University indicates that the people who consume and share junk news in this country are largely conservatives. The extreme hard-right conservatives shared more fake news stories than all other political groups combined, especially on the Twitter machine. On Twitter, a network of Trump supporters consumes the largest volume of junk news, and junk news is the largest proportion of news links that they share. I don't like Twitter. I don't know about you, but I don't spend much time there. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Pass it around. We give it away free, and you'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.